Hi everyone. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming to this evening's event. I'm very pleased to welcome Mark Leonard to IDEAS. My name is Georgia Lawson. I'm a lecturer in international relations here at LSE. Mark, as most of you probably know, is the director of the European Council on Foreign Relations and previously held a senior post at the Centre for European Reform, and previous to that was director of the Foreign Policy Centre, whose patrons once upon a time included Tony Blair, the late Robin Cook, and others. I actually knew Mark before then in his previous incarnation as a researcher at Demos, where we both were in the mid-1990s before New Labour became a swear word. So I can tell you that was some time ago, where he was responsible for a project on rebranding Britain, which later became somewhat bastardised as called Britannia, but nevertheless it was a good project. No prizes for saying who's done better since then. But here he is. Mark was at LSE last for when he was talking about his first book, which is Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century, a book that has held up to very close scrutiny ever since, not least this week. They first have to work out how to rig referenda and get treaties through. But tonight, Mark's talking about his current book, which he will be pleased to sign for people afterwards, and I think copies are available in the corner, which is called What Does China Think? I think, as far as my reading of the book goes, it's offering a different story of the rise of China than we've got elsewhere. It's much less about GDP growth, the development of China as an economic power, much less about its military spending or its growth as a political force, than about the ideas that lie behind China's rise and role and place in the world. And Mark's been over to China a great many times, interviewed dozens of people, and he's got a very interesting line about the different ways that you can group thinkers, intellectuals, and how they think about China's role in the world into three different categories. There's the New Left, this kind of gentler form of capitalism. Capitalism with a human face is how I think about it when I've been reading this kind of Giddensian third way position. This New Right, the Chinese Thatcherites, I guess. And then the neocons, the idea of China using its force to generate a very active foreign policy. But I think what's really interesting to me about Mark's book, which I hope we'll talk about a little bit, is that one thing, when we talk about public intellectuals in the West, and we quite often bemoan the lack of public intellectuals in public discourse in the UK and elsewhere, one thing that Mark's trying to make the case for is that in China, public intellectuals play an enormous role in how domestic and foreign policy is enacted. And in that sense, the conversation between those three groups, if you like, those ideal typical ways of thinking about Chinese domestic and foreign policy, the conversation between them, the debate between them, and their understanding of Chinese power is going to be incredibly important. And if China is genuinely generating some type of novel but stable form of mixed economy and authoritarian political governance, then that poses enormous challenges to the West, challenges which I'm very pleased to welcome Mark to present to us tonight. So Mark, you're very welcome to LSE.
Thank you very much, sir. It's a huge pleasure to be here. And the first book, I didn't only come to LSE to talk about it once it was written, but one of the critical points that really helped me think about it was actually an event which Mick and George organised, where I presented some of the half-formed ideas. So I think you share at least some of the responsibilities for the way that things came out later. And George also reminded me that, like, when we first got to know each other, before George went into the production of ideas, he was a spin doctor at Demos and was always much better at expressing our ideas than we were ourselves. So I kind of feel that talking now after such a comprehensive introduction is almost superfluous. But I will expand on some of the points that George was making. And I'm not going to try and sum up the whole book, but I'll maybe give you a sense and a feel for some of the things some of the debates and arguments and the thinkers that I kind of portray in it. And as George was saying, I mean, the starting point is really a sense that there is a massive discrepancy between the importance of China in the world and how much we know about what makes it tick and what's going on inside the country. And a very strong sense, which I felt the very first time I went to China, but which was reinforced in the years afterwards as I got to know a lot of the main thinkers in China, that we need a fundamental change in the way that we think about China. because until recently people have thought of it mainly as an economic power, as a huge market, as a factory of the world, as a voracious consumer of commodities, a vast source of foreign reserves. More recently people have started to think about China as a political power. They realise that we're not going to be able to solve any global problems, whether it's climate change, the Iranian nuclear crisis, genocide in Darfur, situation in Burma, without having a better grip on what role China can play and trying to influence China's power. But I think even that perception is sort of lagging behind the reality. And I think in the future, as we project forwards, we're going to need to understand China not just what it does, but what it thinks. We're going to need to have a view of China as a powerhouse of ideas that is developing what I think we could almost describe as an ideological alternative to the European and American worldviews. And like many people, as I said before I went to China, I imagined that the intellectual life there consisted of a few unbending ideologues in the back room of Communist Party headquarters, and maybe a few academics in top universities who came up with slogans that were parroted across Chinese society. But in fact, what shocked me even on my very first trip to China was that I stumbled on a huge community of intellectuals who work in think tanks and universities and other places, who are having very big debates about some quite fundamental issues that will shape not just China's future, but potentially have much wider global implications. And this world of intellectuals and think tankers is one which sinologists are aware of, and they come across these people. But it is striking that whereas the West pours over the minutest details in the debates between even particular groupings of intellectuals in America, the sort of difference between Francis Fukuyama and Robert Kagan, and most people struggle to name more than a handful of Chinese thinkers at all. So my book is trying to come up with almost a sort of portrait of this intellectual class, the new intelligentsia in China, and to look at some of the big debates that they're having in party forums and universities and think tanks and journals and on the internet. And the macro thesis, to the extent that there is one, is that a lot of Western thinking and a lot of our assumptions about China have been underpinned by a basic belief that as China becomes richer, it will become more like us. But in fact, I think that the opposite is happening. As China becomes richer and more developed and grows in confidence, its intellectuals are actually, whilst absorbing and using lots of ideas from the West, they're trying to liberate themselves to the West. A lot of them are calling for what they call a second liberation of thought. They want to free their country from what they see as a blind adherence to neoliberal economics and to Western ideas about foreign policy, and a kind of almost a hero worship of the United States of America. The first liberation of thought was when Deng Xiaoping freed China from the sort of Marxist-Leninist thinking. So they see this need to free themselves from Western thinking on a par with what happened exactly 30 years ago when the opening and reform era began. So anyway, in the book I kind of look at three basic areas where this debate is taking place, and in economics, ideas about political reform and foreign policy and world order. So I think the starting point for this intellectual emancipation is a debate about what model of capitalism China should embrace and develop. And in one corner, as George said, you have economists like Zhang Weiying, who form the core of a pro-market new right. They were the people who pioneered the gradualist economic reforms of the 1980s and the 1990s that allowed China to thrive in the incredible way that it has over the last few years. And they now want the state to finish the job off and to privatise the rest of the economy. A lot of these people came of age intellectually in the 1980s, and when Thatcher and Reagan were ruling the roost, and they therefore have a kind of almost Chinese variant of Reaganomics and tend to be quite right wing. But the way they go about implementing it has been obviously enormously successful and very creative. Zhang Weiying, who's one of these leading economists, has got an allegory which he really likes to use to explain how him and a group of other reformers managed to get the Communist Party to agree to free market reforms. And he tells a story about a village that relied on horses to conduct all of its chores. But things were going fine, except over time the village leaders realised that the village next door that used zebras rather than horses was doing much better than them. So they decided that they were going to have to somehow abandon the horses and embrace zebras. But the problem was that the legitimacy of their rule was based on a story that zebras were evil creatures that would pollute your mind and destroy your society, and that horses were the embodiment of all that was good. So they tried to work out how they could have this switch without losing their credibility and losing their ability to rule the village. And in the end, they came up with a pretty ingenious plan, which was to wait until the villagers were asleep, and then to gradually start painting stripes on the horses. And the next morning, the villagers kind of woke up and were shocked at the presence of these evil, stripy beasts in their midst. And the village elders explained to them that these were just the same old horses, they'd just been, like, you know, vandalised by people, and there's nothing to worry about, they weren't zebras at all. And villagers kind of accepted that version of events and just got on with their lives. So they carried on painting a few more horses every night until all the horses had been painted. And then a bit later they started substituting the painted horses for real zebras. And as the proportion of horses to zebras, sorry, the proportion of zebras to horses increased, the village started doing better and better. Everyone was enormously wealthy, you know, they were benefiting from this massive dividend. Golden taps were appearing in all the mud huts in the village, and everyone was incredibly rich. And it was only many years later, long after all the horses had been replaced with zebras and the village had completely transformed, that the elders actually summoned the citizenry together and proclaimed that their community was a village of zebras, and that zebras were good and horses were bad, and everyone accepted this because the reality had been changed. This story is used partly to explain one of Zhang Weiying's most famous ideas. He was one of the economists, I think he was the first one to publicly call for what he called dual-track pricing. And this was an idea that came out in the 1980s. And this was a plan for moving the economy from an economy where prices were set by officials to one where they were set by the market. But to do that without publicly having to abandon your commitment to socialism or to run into opposition from vested interests that had a stake in central planning. So what they did was very similar to the village elders. They started selling a proportion of goods at market prices whilst keeping other things sold at state-set prices. And over time, the proportion sold by market prices grew until by the early 90s, almost all products were sold at market prices. So rather than closing down the old system and moving lock, stock and barrel to a new one, the trick was to create an alternative reality within that system and then to gradually grow it over time. And that really is the kind of essence of the model of reform in China. The most famous village of zebras which was created is probably Shenzhen, which the beginning of the 1980s was a pretty unremarkable fishing village that barely managed to feed a few thousand fishermen and their families. But now, obviously, is this gleaming metropolis that acts as a kind of poster boy for Chinese idea of capitalism. It was the first special economic zone which was created. Its leaders were offered tax breaks, freedom from regulation, a license to pioneer new market ideas. And as a result of special economic zones and these kind of experiments with the market, what you saw is the reformers of the eastern provinces being allowed to cut free from the impoverished inland areas within China, steaming ahead and creating vast amount of wealth by drawing on savings, revenues from exports, and the ability to suck in endless numbers of workers from the countryside in order to hold down urban wages. And so you saw this weird economic system develop, which is very laissez-faire. There's no, it's a trickle-down economic system rather than one which is based on redistributing wealth from the rich parts of China to the poorer bits of China. But these ideas obviously worked very well and brought hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. But after 30 years of success and of these economists basically ruling the roost with ideas which have imported from the West, the tide of opinion in China is starting to to turn against economists like Zhang Weiying. There's a lot of public disquiet now over the growing costs of reform, the fact that China's gone from being one of the most equal countries in the world to a country more unequal than the United States. There are protests from laid-off workers coming together with concern over illegal demolitions, corruption, unpaid wages, pensions, environmental problems. 87,000 people, 87,000 protests happened last year, so 300 every day. And there is a battle which is increasingly emerging, which pits the state against the market, the coast against the inland provinces, the towns against the countryside, the rich against the poor. And there is also a sense that the debate of the 1980s, where the country was split between reformers and conservatives, is giving way to a new debate where the reform camp has split into two. So the old kind of dinosaurs that are against the market have disappeared, more or less. But not everybody believes in untrammeled economic reforms anymore. And there is a new loose grouping of intellectuals which is increasingly capturing the public mood that started to emerge in the 1990s around people like Wang Hui, who was a student of literature, actually, during the 1990s when he was a big supporter of market reforms, along with people like Zhang Weiying. But he was gradually politicised, first of all, through his role in the student demonstrations of 1989 in Tiananmen Square. And like many intellectuals then, he was basically a strong believer in the potential of the market. But after Tiananmen Square, he took off to the mountains, he spent a few years in hiding, got to know peasants and workers. And these sorts of experiences, together with things which were already starting to happen in China in the late 1980s, in the run-up to Tiananmen, these problems of growing inequality, corruption, things which the market was creating, began to make him doubt the justice of unregulated free markets, convinced him that the state has to play a role in preventing inequality. And his ideas, I think, were developed further along with other people like him in the 1990s, but most of them were in exile during that time because as a result of the post-Tiananmen crackdown. The group of scholars that are around, I think, are new because, unlike the old left, they basically support market reforms. But they're left because, unlike Zhang Weiying and the new right, they worry deeply about inequality and the environmental suicide that their country is committing with its unregulated, untrammeled charge towards economic growth. And their philosophy is really a product of China's relative affluence. They kind of say that now that the market is driving economic growth, what should we do with the wealth? Should it just continue accumulating in the hands of a small elite? Or can China foster a different model of development that benefits all its citizens? And essentially, they would never call it this because they're quite clear that China needs to forge its own path. It needs to liberate its thinking from other parts of the world. But to an ethnocentric European like me, it looks like a Chinese variant of social democracy that they're calling for. They talk about developing low-price healthcare, about socialized capital, about protecting public property as well as private property to make sure that it isn't all bought out in corrupt management buyouts, about giving workers a say over the companies where they work, about green development, and they're calculating ways of measuring Chinese growth which takes out the cost of environmental destruction. And they're reporting a lot of new left ideas. I mean, it's not just a classic idea of social democracy. There's some very modern thinking about employee share ownership and things like that which are being developed. And I think what we're seeing at the moment is the balance of power in Beijing is shifting subtly towards the left. At the end of 2005, Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao published the 11th five-year plan, which was their blueprint for a harmonious society. And for this document, I think it was quite an important milestone in China's development, because though it's pretty vague and the ideas haven't really been implemented yet, it's more of a rhetorical shift than one in actual practice. That document is the first time where the overriding goal for China is not described simply as economic growth. It's a plan which talks about introducing a welfare state with promises of 20% year-on-year increases in funds for pensions, unemployment benefits, health insurance, maternity leave. For rural China, they promise an end to arbitrary taxes, improved health and education. They pledge to cut energy consumption by 20% year-on-year. And I think it's the template for a new kind of Chinese model of development. It borrows a lot from the 1980s reformers, people like Zhang Weiying, this idea of permanent experimentation, gradualist reform rather than shock therapy. It accepts their belief in the market as the principal way of driving economic growth. But from the new left, it does draw a deep concern about inequality and the environment, a quest for new institutions that can marry cooperation with competition. And it is essentially, I think, a coherent idea for a different type of state capitalism from the one which you had in the 1980s, and which is obviously fundamentally different from the ideas of the Washington Consensus. So that's one basket of reform. Brings me really to the second area, political reform. And I think that the lure of the China model, to the extent that there is one internationally, doesn't just stem from Beijing's economic success story. I think in the future what we could find is that many states are as attracted to China's model of adaptive authoritarianism as they have been to its industrial planning and its model of capitalism in the past. Because the outside world tends to look at how China's economic reforms have gone hand in hand, well, tends to assume that these revolutionary changes to the economy have gone hand in hand with political stagnation. Whereas in fact, I think that if you study the way that China's political system works, you'll find that it has been transformed almost as much as the economy has over the last generation. But many in the West have failed to spot this trend because the direction of travel hasn't been towards liberal democracy. I think what we're finding is that in the same way that in the economic realm, there's been a big shift from the debates in the 1980s to the 1990s, there's been an equally large shift in the political realm. Because if you obviously went back to China in the 80s, they were having debates about multi-party elections, about liberalising the political system, separation of the party from the government. But now I think there is a different sort of debate going on. There are still some thinkers in China, some pretty prominent ones who believe in democracy, but I think their voice is less loud, and that's not simply because it's much more difficult to talk about these ideas than it was in the late 1980s in the run-up to Tiananmen. The most famous booster for democracy is a man called Yu Keping, who is like the Zhang Weiying of political reform. He wrote quite a controversial book last year called Democracy is a Good Thing. Lots of people in the West saw this as a sign that China was moving in a liberal direction, the fact that someone wrote a book called Democracy is a Good Thing. What I think they fail to understand is actually that you wouldn't have had to write a book called Democracy is a Good Thing in the late 1980s, and it wouldn't have been such a controversial thing, because most of the intellectual elite thought that democracy was a good thing. This is a very defensive book, saying, I understand all the arguments against democracy, and it has all these flaws and it's disastrous for all these sorts of things, but nevertheless, it's a good thing. And it was a shocking title for that sort of reason. But anyway, he is like Zhang Weiying, because when he thinks about China's political future, often draws a pretty direct analogy between political reform and economic reform. When I last met him in Beijing, he told me that he thought overnight political reform would be as damaging to China's survival as economic shock therapy would have been to its economy. And instead, he's promoted an idea which he calls incremental democracy. The idea is that democracy will gradually work its way up from successful grassroots experiments. And he hopes that by promoting democracy first within the Communist Party, it will then spread to the rest of society. So in the same way that the coastal regions were seen as the natural place to start market experiments, he sees that the Communist Party is the first place to start with democratic experiments. And whilst his centre looks at all sorts of experiments in grassroots democracy all over the country, and they hand out prizes for the most exciting ones through elections in different places, the things that really excite him are these party elections within the party and the reform within the party. And there are, I went to visit some of the examples of this actually happening. One place I went, his suggestions are a place called Pingchang, which is in Sichuan province. Which is the first place where, first county where they decided to allow party members to vote for the bosses of the township parties. The township is one level up from the village. You've got various different layers in government, from village to township to county to
to province to and, up to the national level. And normally what happens is each level simply appoints the party bosses for the level underneath it. So it's quite revolutionary to turn it on its head and allow party members to vote for their party bosses. And anyway, in the long run, the idea is that you could see democracy gradually working its way up to the upper echelons of the party, and you could eventually one day have competitive elections for the most senior posts. They've just done that in Vietnam, and lots of Chinese people say, ah, that could be a model for us. And there was certainly there is certainly more competition being introduced within the party. And if it did happen, it would not be a trivial event, because the Communist Party, if it were a country with 70 million members, would be rather larger than the UK. But nevertheless, in spite of that, I think it's pretty difficult to imagine this remote, impoverished, I can't tell you how kind of hard and primitive the conditions are for a lot of the people who live in Pyeongchang. So bad, actually, that most of the people there are not of working age and are not men. It looks a bit like a war zone, because all the kind of men of working age have gone to work in other bits of China, leaving behind their kids and people who are too frail to work in other places. It was not a kind of happy and exciting place. It's difficult to see Shanghai, Beijing, Shenzhen, these gleaming metropolises, actually adapting themselves to be more like Pyeongchang. And so far, none of the other 2,500 counties in China have actually followed its lead. But I think there's a more fundamental reason why this might not be the dominant way that China's politics changes. And that's the fact that many intellectuals are actually starting to question whether elections are useful at all. So you've always had a debate in China about sequencing. Should we do economic reform first or political reform first? And most people thought that economic reform had to happen before political reform. But now there's a question about where you're going to end up. It's not just about the sequencing, it's about the ultimate destination. And the most kind of lively thinkers who have the highest profile and I think setting the debate in the most dramatic way are people who are on that side of the equation. People like Pan Wei, who's a rising star at Beijing University, and he basically says, if you look at the long list of problems facing China at the moment, very, very few of them will be solved by having elections. In fact, he thinks elections will make a lot of these things worse. These are contentious arguments, and I'm not going to go into them. But this is what he thinks, and I don't think it's just rhetoric. I don't think it's just because he's a young man in a hurry. He basically can also point to a lot of problems which developed democracies are facing. You know, they read the news, they look at what's happening here, they see turnout falling, faith in political leaders collapsing, parties losing members, populism on the rise. And him and people like him will say, actually, you know, if you look at your democratic systems in the West, you're pretty disillusioned with democracy. With elective democracy, and you're trying to find techniques to reach the people which go beyond elections, using referenda. We've seen a huge success that was in Ireland. Public hearings, citizens' juries, opinion surveys, constant polling, focus groups. And he says that in the West, you have multi-party elections as the central part of the process, and then this whole deliberative paraphernalia all around it to supplement it, because elections just won't cut the mustard, and they're not good enough anymore in a more complex society. And so he says, actually, what you need to do is turn that China is going to do things exactly the other way around. They will carry on having elections like they do at village level, maybe even go up to township level one day. But that's going to be a pretty marginal part of the political process, allow people to let off steam. But the core bit in the future will be these other things, public consultations, expert meetings, surveys, and they're going to be turned into a central part of decision-making. And this idea was summed up pithily by another political scientist who kind of the same persuasion, a man called Feng Ning, who's at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. He's one of the key people who worked on the white paper on democracy, which was published a couple of years ago. And he basically used quite an interesting analogy. He said that democracy in the West is like a fixed menu restaurant where customers can choose who their chef is. So we get to choose whether we have French or Chinese food or Japanese food. But once you've chosen the chef, they'll basically cook whatever they want for you. And he says that in China, you don't get to choose who your chef is. It's going to be the Communist Party. But in the future, increasingly, you'll get to choose what policy dishes are served up à la carte. And that is actually starting to be tried out in various different places. Chongqing is a city that's been in the news recently because of the earthquake, and it's a huge place, bigger than most European countries. And it is a living laboratory for the ideas of people like Pan Wei and Feng Ning. Their government has basically decided to make all significant decisions subject to public hearings and personal television on the internet. So when they decided whether to ban fireworks after some horrific accidents on New Year's Eve day, they had a big debate about it and came up with a system of regulation that reflected that. They had a hearing on what price they should set for the light railway system. And there are various other ideas like that. In fact, James Fishkin, a Stanford political scientist, came up with this idea of deliberative polling. It's actually been brought to China to try some of these experiments out at a local level. In a place called Zeguo, they actually decided how to spend their whole public works budget on the basis of one of these deliberative polls. Anyway, what you're seeing from this is a kind of Darwinian form of dictatorship emerging, which is much more adaptive, much more in touch with public opinion, which is increasingly using increasingly sophisticated techniques to preempt discontent, to understand what people want. And I think that what's emerging is what I call a model of deliberative dictatorship, which I think could prove that one-party states can deliver quite a lot of political stability and popular legitimacy, because they are based on a degree of consent and a knowledge of what's going on. They've got much higher levels of information about what's going on than in many kind of traditional authoritarian regimes. Anyway, that's the kind of debate on politics. I realise I've been going on at some length. I'll try and be a bit quicker on the third set of issues, which is about world order. I think what's striking there is that, again, there's been a big shift in the debate from the 1980s. And there's a much more self-confident discourse that's emerging there. The big idea of China in the under Deng Xiaoping was the idea that China should hide its brightness, that it should keep as low a profile as possible, never be a leader, not take risks, because leaders get lumbered with all sorts of responsibilities. Basically try and reassure the rest of the world, don't get involved in any conflict, and to bide its time, build its power up, and so it's an essentially defensive foreign policy predicated on the idea of trying to be as invisible as possible. But I think that is something which is obviously changing dramatically. And the Olympics, in a way, is the kind of stage which is being built to show us this new China, and where it's coming, where the new ideas in China are coming under a lot of scrutiny and being adapted to deal with the amount of attention that they're getting. But I think, anyway, one of the really interesting ideas for me is that in the same way as they've done in the economic realm and in the political realm, a lot of the ideas which are driving this change in Chinese thinking are Western ideas, but they're being turned on their head and being used to do different things. So in the same way that the market is used not to deliver profits, but to deliver political goals, that these ideas of more deliberative political change are used in very different ways from the West. I think what you're seeing there is a lot of cutting-edge ideas about globalisation, well, maybe less cutting-edge, but anyway, modern Western ideas about globalisation being turned on their head to strengthen what the Chinese like to call comprehensive national power, which is a kind of national obsession, the idea of comprehensive national power. Every think tank in China has developed an index to try and give a numerical value to the country's power, which allows them to compare it with other countries around the world. And I think the idea of CNP, as they call it, is quite interesting because it tells you, first of all, that there is a pretty unashamed focus on national power, even in an age of interdependence. It's national power that's being sought. But also the idea of comprehensiveness, I think, is quite important. Because it shows that their ideas on power are very, very wide. I'll mention just three ideas that I think they have turned on their head, which kind of play into this, which are soft power, multilateralism, and asymmetric warfare. They're all ideas that we in the West associate with a decline in the power of the nation state. In China, they're kind of used to do the opposite. Soft power is maybe the most interesting one. A very prominent Chinese military thinker called Yang Yi, who runs one of China's leading military think tanks. And he basically talks about soft power not in the way that we think about it as Hollywood and, you know, other kind of non-state actors, but about capturing the moral high ground of international relations. He argues that the United States has captured that moral high ground and created what he calls a strategic siege around China by basically being able to decide what is right and what's wrong in international relations. So what makes the Chinese absolutely furious is this idea of the responsible stakeholder, which Robert Zoellick came up with, which is basically that the US has decided that it can choose what is responsible and what's irresponsible. And every time China tries to assert itself in diplomatic terms, spend money on modernizing its military, opening relationships with other countries that are disapproved of in the West, that they're told that they are... They either do what America tells them to do, or they're branded as irresponsible. And until quite recently, a lot of the world has believed these judgments which were cast. So one of the goals is really to try and turn that equation round, and to have an ability to shape international discourse. And there's lots of thinking about how China can build its soft power and capture the moral high ground in international relations. A few years ago, there was a conference on developing a China dream, China's answer to the American dream. And the basic idea is to try and associate China with some powerful ideas, like economic development based on its experience so far, political sovereignty, the ability to kind of shape your own affairs in an era of globalization and American military power, and international law. Taking longer than I should do, so I'm not going to go into great detail on the other ones, but I would maybe talk a bit about international law and asymmetric warfare together as a single point. Lots of people, if you think about asymmetric warfare, lots of people associate that with terrorists and, you know, Viet Cong, Al-Qaeda, other sorts of people. China's kind of turned that onto taken that up to an industrial scale. And the basic idea is to try and become try and become an asymmetric superpower. So there are lots of different aspects to this. There are some military ones which are much written about, you know, such as getting to a position where you can shoot down satellites so that you blind America, and if there's a war over Taiwan. So rather than trying to match U.S. military might, dollar for dollar, plane for plane, bomb for bomb, which is what many Chinese people think led to the downfall of the Soviet Union, what you try and do is come up with these asymmetric strategies. But what's interesting is, going back to the idea of comprehensive national power, these ideas are taken out of the military realm. And there are lots of thinking about how you can use international law and multilateral bodies like the United Nations to try and pin down Western powers and change the facts on the ground and the way that the issues work out. And I think that's a very interesting point, because certainly in Europe, we associate multilateralism with the dilution of national sovereignty, about being bound by supranational rules in places like the EU and the WTO. But as in China, I think that multilateralism and international law is seen more as a tool of power projection that reinforces national sovereignty and allows China to develop links with other countries that exclude the US, that put American allies in the region like Japan on the defensive. And you've seen that very dramatically in its support for regional integration in the East Asian community, for example. And also the creation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization with Russia and Central Asian republics. But anyway, I'll try to bring that section to an end. But anyway, I think that most Chinese thinkers basically agree on this goal of strengthening comprehensive national power. But there is a big argument about where they want to end up in the end and how to do it. And I think there are debates between people who are more motivated by a kind of liberal internationalism, people like Zhang Bijian, for example, who came up with the idea of China's peaceful rise. And they'll talk about how China's rejoined the world as playing a more responsible role within the existing system and wants to fight for a bigger role within that. And there are, on the other hand, people who are more assertive nationalists. They're kind of China's answer to the neocons in America. I call them the neocons because they are trying to use modern thinking to help realize ancient dreams about overthrowing Western dominance and stopping the appeasement of the West. And their long-term goal is to see China return to kind of great power status and build an order in its own image. I can talk more about that in the discussion afterwards. But just to bring it together, I think if you look at those different sets of debates, what you see is a gradual shift in self-confidence and an attempt to move away from blindly following Western thinking. And though there are these big arguments between very, very different perspectives in each of those different areas, there is a kind of consensus that is emerging through those debates, which isn't formed yet and is still very much a work in progress, but I think which is being gradually distilled into a kind of Chinese model. And the golden thread which links all of these emerging ideas is a quest for control. Essentially, Chinese thinkers want to create a world where national governments can be masters of their own destiny rather than subject to the whims, on the one hand, of global capital and on the other, of American unilateral foreign policy. And if you think about it and you look in each of those different areas, those ideas, the Chinese model of capitalism, the idea of deliberative dictatorship, the idea of comprehensive national power, are the building blocks, I think, of what could be seen as a new Chinese philosophy of globalization that's emerging. And I think together they pose a pretty powerful challenge to the prevailing wisdom of the last few years, the idea of a flat world where the state's role was diminished because it was gradually, step by step, driven out of the economic realm by privatization, out of the political realm by democratization and the human rights revolution, and out of the foreign policy realm by the rise of stateless forces and American power. And I think that you could see them as an answer to that and a direct full frontal challenge to that way of thinking about things. So I think I want to end by just talking a bit about how these ideas could actually change our lives and how they could affect the rest of the world, because I think that's maybe one other thing that's worth spending a bit of time dwelling on, which is because lots of people have written about China's rise, and China is a revolutionary power that wants to overthrow the existing system and create a new world in its image. And some of these people have even been Chinese, though they tend to be more coy about those sorts of things. But yet, when you look at Chinese behaviour, it's quite puzzling. It doesn't follow the kind of pattern of other great powers in history. And though people like Wolfowitz talk about Wilhelmine China and compare China, and Bob Kagan recently has compared China with the US and the way that it itself rose, China does seem to behave in a very different way and is much more self-conscious. But I think that maybe if we want to understand how China will change the world and how it will affect the rest of us, we need to start by looking at how China changed its own system. And this goes back to the very beginning, the story of zebras and horses and where we started, which is that, you know, there were these revolutionary changes to China's system, but the point was not about a full frontal assault on the status quo. It wasn't about closing down one system and opening another one. It was a much more gradualist development where you create an alternative market reality that works alongside the old planned economy, and over time you create this shift. And I think if we really want to understand how China is changing the world, we need to look not for these revolutionary full frontal changes, but for some pockets of an alternative Chinese order which has been built and which embodies some of these ideas that I was talking about beforehand. And I'm just going to mention very briefly some of them. The most dramatic ones and the easiest ones to find are obviously in the economic realm, because I think the Marxists are right that the economy is obviously the base on which all these superstructural things are built. And the place which is most dramatic on that is obviously is Africa. There's a really dramatic event, I think, a kind of emblematic event, which was just a matter of months ago, which is when Hu Jintao proudly announced the creation of a brand new special economic zone. But this one was very different from Shenzhen and the other ones which had been developed in the 1980s, because this one was in Zambia. It was a metals hub which China is creating there, and it's the first of five which is being built in Africa, and it shows they're literally transplanting their economic model into another continent. So building these hubs which are linked by road, shipping, rail links to the rest of the world, and Chinese countries are busy competing to get these special economic zones in a similar way to the way that Central and Eastern European countries competed to join the European Union. I mean, that's just the kind of small illustration of a bigger trend, that as China gets more involved in other parts of the world, people are copying its development model and is changing the rules of economic development and completely transforming the lives of Western donors and agencies like the IMF and the World Bank, etc. In the political realm, it's less dramatic, but you can also see China sharing its experiences and people learning from China. There's a lot written about Chinese support for regimes in Burma, Zimbabwe, Central Asia, and other sorts of places where China's given these governments a degree of protection. But I think what's more interesting is the way that they're advising the Burmese on how to modernise their political systems. They're providing people with advice on political reform and surveillance and other sorts of things like that. But maybe most dramatic is in the foreign policy realm, where I think China has created some, has both created some new organisations that enshrine a Chinese approach to the world, but also managed to change the existing organisations to reflect more of a Chinese worldview. So if you look at these new multilateral bodies, like I mentioned them before, but the Shanghai Cooperation Organisation, which China developed with Russia and five Central Asian republics, if you look at the moves toward the creation of the East Asian community, you can see that China is basically both reassuring its neighbours of its peaceful intent, giving them some institutionalised ways of dealing with their rise, is creating a new community of interest that excludes the United States. They talk even of turning Japan into a kind of UK of East Asia as regional integration continues. But the core idea is that if you look at how these institutions work, they enshrine a Chinese idea of how order should be done. So they enshrine ideas of non-intervention in your internal affairs. They don't have the sort of political standards that we have in Western organisations, etc. And if you look at the UN, that is another really interesting way. It's kind of slowly, in a quiet way, been changed into becoming a powerful amplifier of a Chinese worldview. So the Chinese don't veto things gratuitously. They don't enjoy creating problems for the West in the way that Russia does. But slowly, the balance of power within the UN has been shifting. And if you look at votes on human rights, for example, 10 years ago, China won 43% of the votes. Last year, it won 82% of the votes. And during the same period of time, the US has gone from winning 57% to 22% of the votes. The approach in all these things is to avoid confrontation whilst changing the facts on the ground. And I think what you are seeing is some pockets of an alternative reality, where it's Chinese values and norms that determine the course of events rather than Western ones. So I think that's really how things are moving forward. People ask whether this is sustainable, whether it will last, whether the Chinese model really exists, whether it's built on feet of clay. And I think it's quite possible that in the long run, this formula of state capitalism, open markets and a closed political system will collapse. But I think it is worth noting that it took three generations for a Soviet economic model that didn't work in theory to actually fail in practice. And until the very moment that it collapsed, the Soviet Union did embody an alternative model that challenged Western liberal democracy. I don't think China's model is anything like the Soviet model. It's not a totalizing ideology in that sense. It's a very pragmatic regime that is linked in with the West and borrows selectively, as I illustrated earlier, many ideas from the West. But I do think that while it's working, it is increasingly seen as a model in other parts of the world. And Beijing's rise has already fundamentally changed the balance of economic and military power in the world. It's starting, I think, gradually to change not simply the those facts of hard power, but it is gradually starting to change the world's ideas about how politics, economics, and order should be organised. And what we're seeing through all of this, I think, is for the first time since the end of the Cold War, a formidable alternative to European and American ideas about how the world should be organised. And that is the Chinese model.